Nailed it.
Work with me here, guys.
And short, really quick.
You could have finished it with a tiny report.
Yes.
You're right. You could have stayed home. Could have stayed home to get this all. Okay, Herb. Actually, Aaron, we'll start with you and then go that way. We're going to go backwards.
Hot set. Just reading one verse.
One verse. Pass it on.
Greatly have they afflicted me from my youth. Let Israel now say.
Greatly have they afflicted me from my youth, yet they have not prevailed against me. Okay.
Why did you bounce over there?
Huh?
What?
Where are we at?
No, her. We're going that way.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Anyway? Sorry. Okay. Psalm
129. That's opposite way. Oh, okay. We went opposite.
I did say, that's what I said. I said, no, let's go that way.
Oh, I didn't see that.
Saved.
The flowers.
You and Brad need to listen a little better.
The plowers plowed upon my back. They made long their furrows.
The Lord is righteous. He has cut the cords of the wicked.
May all who hate Zion be put to shame and turned backward.
Let them be like the grass on the housetops, which withers before it grows up.
With which the reaper does not fill his hand, nor the binder of sheaves his arms.
Nor do those who pass by say, the blessing of the Lord be upon you. We bless you in the name of the Lord.
Okay, so the basic perspective that Peterson makes of this psalm is, what does he see this as?
Perseverance,
endurance, right? And the point of it, of course, is this is sort of a cry of... in the face of difficulty, I will remain strong, right? And so he's reflecting on the sort of the struggle and the pain, but he does it in a very interesting, poetic, and even humorous way, right? He makes a couple statements. This is really interesting. You remember how last week I told you you have to be really careful when you... Not careful... you have to be understanding when you read somebody like Peterson. He allows Psalm 128 to stand on its own. The Christian life is easy, right? Psalm 129 is anything but easy. It's exactly the opposite. In fact, this psalm is about the grit that Christians have to have, right? Somehow those two psalms go together, and he doesn't have a problem letting them both stand as they are. What's the difference? How can Psalm 128 say the Christian life is the easiest thing in the world, and Psalm 129 say, but you have to have an intense amount of grit and stick-to-itiveness is a word that he used. Was it his mom who taught him that? Son, you don't have any stick-to-itiveness, right?
The first one is dealing with God. And this
great.
One is dealing with people.
Perfect. Yeah, the first one is, what kind of blessings do we get from God? Do you have to have grit to receive blessings from the Lord? No, a humble trust. That's it. But the grit comes when there are multitudes of enemies and people that want to keep you from getting those blessings. And so they scratch and claw and keep you from trying to obtain the rich blessings of God, right? And he uses Jesus as an example of somebody who has this intense endurance and stick-to-itiveness, right? You think of the life of Christ. The one thing that we know the life of Christ was not characterized by was ease, right? I don't know if you've thought about this. He didn't mention this. He starts with the wilderness. But even the birth of Jesus is surrounded by death, right? He has to flee his own homeland. He goes down into Egypt. His parents are basically like refugees, right? Like religious or political refugees trying to protect the baby Jesus. I mean, from the very word go, his life is turmoil. It is confusion. It is, even to the time he's a child. Remember, we looked at the Gospel of Luke. there's sort of resolution in his heart, but his parents are ticked off and confused about him, right? He's in the temple, and he should have been on the road back to his house. There isn't a part of Jesus' life where he just kicks his feet up and is like, this is the best, right? And yet at the same time, Jesus is characterized by an intense, deep joy, satisfaction, contentment in the Lord, right? So it's exactly, his relationship with the Lord is one thing, but his relationship to the world is something totally different. And so Peterson talks about the fact that the Christian life isn't, or the life of faith, is not a fragile thing. It's not a glass dove that sits on a shelf. It is scratched, clawed, scuffed, chipped, right? And yet there it is. It keeps going. He also says faith is not a fad. Can you think of a parable where Jesus illustrates this point?
Parable of the sower?
No. Yeah, the parable of the sower. That's exactly what I was thinking.
Oh, okay.
Go ahead.
Oh, just that the seeds are sown and some are thrown on rocky places and then others are received on fertile soil, but then they grow up quickly and then die, right?
Yep.
And then obviously the other ones that find fertile ground and grow and flourish, etc.
Yeah, so some really excited and really enthusiastic, and then peter away. Some when the temptations come, peter away. Some when the trials come, peter away. The Peterson said that the life of faith isn't a fad. It's not the shallow weed that grows and then withers away. True faith is enduring. True faith has this perseverance, this patience, this endurance, and stick-to-itiveness. Now, there's three things I want to say about endurance. One is, it's a gift from the Lord, right? Perseverance is not about human grit. Despite what he might say, it's not about human grit. It's about the power of God inside of us, upholding us. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
It's not a personality trait. Right? Have you ever met people that just have super duper disciplined grit? They grind day after day, whatever they do. It wouldn't matter if they're at work, doesn't matter if they're at play, they just grind. That's not what faith is. Faith is not a personality trait. It is a gift from the Lord. Second, this psalm says that the Lord repays. Did you notice that there's a reversal in the psalm? Did anybody read this? Did I? Since I didn't put it out, did anybody read it?
I did not.
Oh, so you guys are all like, this is really interesting, Mark. And now I
maybe
there.
Did you
read
it? Brad had checked the outline for it. I may not have been able to find the inbox.
Okay, so just based on reading it, did you notice a reversal? And it's actually quite humorous the way that the thing is reversed, the psalm reverses. So what are the wicked doing to him in verse 3? Plowing his back, right? That's a pretty vivid image, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, can you imagine having a cow and you got the guy sitting on the back with the weighting it trying to down on the cow, and it's your back that the grooves are being dug in where they're going to plant the seeds, right? That's how he feels. But notice at the end what they are like. Verse 5. May they be put to shame, like may they be like grass, and may they be like flowers and that don't actually ever come in, that God destroys them so quickly. Even before anybody has a chance to say, those are great crops, the Lord bless you. Right? In other words, he's mocking them, and there's a humorous jab. Like, even their God will destroy them so quickly that even their neighbors will not be able to sort of congratulate them in all the things that they've gotten. So there's a swath. So at one point, the people of God are like the field that's being churned. In the end, though, they are like the field that is churned. God repays the people who disturb his people. This is a constant theme in the scriptures. That this is one of the things that gives us patience and endurance, is because God is not forgetful regarding the sufferings of his people. And he stands ready to bless them with more than they have to lose for him. The second thing is he rewards them, right? The tables are turned. Instead of being on the bottom, they're on the top. The people of God, in the end, win. Their stick-to-itiveness and their endurance pays off in unbounded blessing and fruitfulness from God. Think about Jesus, right? Where does his life end? If his life is not one of ease in this life, what does the cross give way to? Heaven, right? The resurrection. Glorification, right? This psalm illustrates that though, yeah, it may feel like my back is being plowed right now, in the end, it gives birth and gives way to good, glory, and fruitfulness from God. Right? Think about the Beatitudes. Like, blessed are the poor in spirit, because theirs is the kingdom. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. There's a reversal that takes place in the Beatitudes. The one has to do the present, if I could put them in a column, on this side, the mourning, the hungering, the thirsting, the meek, all describe our life here. This side describes the life as it will be when Christ comes again. And it's a complete reversal. So hungering, thirsting, meek, gives way to exactly the opposite. This psalm is illustrating that point. That the tables will turn, right? The church may get its teeth kicked in now because she suffers with her Savior, right? She's identified with Jesus, bears the cross. But the cross always gives way to the resurrection. The world, if you just think about it this way, the world is moving in this... That's not good. These were at church. Shoot. It's been so long since. Is moving in this trajectory. The church is moving in that trajectory. So they look like things are good here, right? Things are great here. But where does it end?
Death.
And it looks like things are bad. It's not really, but it looks like that. It looks difficult, right? Suffering and all that sort of stuff. And it gives way. Life. Yeah. That's just the trick. And right now we're sort of crossing paths. Right? Well, look at that. That's great. So what are we supposed to do with... He starts addressing a really interesting question. And what are you supposed to do with the command to love our enemies? And psalms like this, where he's calling down curses upon other people. You know, let them be ashamed, let them grovel, let them be destroyed. Deal with that.
Well, one, you're calling God to do those things, to judge, but
okay,
it's not our place to do that.
Okay, good.
He calls us to bless.
Okay. That's one possible resolution, is the perspective from which the psalmist is speaking.
Cry out for justice, right?
Okay.
Since there's obviously in an imbalance of justice where things are going wrong and people die and all that kind of stuff, right?
Good. Yeah, so did you guys understand the difference between those two? The subtle difference between what Steve said and what Herb said?
One's on God's side and one's on man's side?
Yeah. Well, they're both trusting God, right? They're both appealing to God, but just in different perspectives, different ways. He brings up the Leviticus where Eugene does not see any distance or difference between what Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount and what Leviticus said about loving our enemies. He thinks that Jesus is not doing something radically new when he says love your enemies and pray for those who harm you. That Jesus is essentially affirming what Leviticus said, Leviticus 18 and 19, which I found really interesting. In fact, I have a whole, like, two pages highlighted in my version of this, because it's a very different way of understanding what Jesus is doing in the Sermon on the Mount. I was always taught that that what Jesus is doing is radically different, is that Israel was allowed to hate her enemies or destroy her enemies, where the church is not allowed to do that. He says that that's never been true. Even going so far that Israel is commanded that if they have enemies and they find their cattle is like broken their gates and left the, they have to return the cattle to their enemies. They don't have the right to make that a spoil. They have to take it back to their enemies. Right? I mean, so legislation indicates that Israel, while at war, even can't harbor hatred. Right? Which is really, really fascinating.
And opposed to Deuteronomy as well.
Right. Bit. Yeah. Yeah, so, yeah, Leviticus and Deuteronomy definitely do similar kinds of things. The way it comes to expression in Deuteronomy is, do you guys remember that when they go to war and it says the men are killed and you've taken wives for yourselves? So you have to allow them, I don't remember what it was, like 6 months or something to grieve. You can't touch them. You can't do anything to them. You have to allow them to grieve the loss they just suffered. And you can't destroy their trees. You can't destroy the nests of the birds. You can't, God is very specific. Like, war is going to happen, but these are the things you cannot do in war. And it's really fascinating, God's concerns, even inside of an inherently sinful situation, which is what war is there is, we may believe in war in our world, but it is an inherently sinful situation. War is a part of our fallen world. It's not a part of God's designs and creation. Nevertheless, God says, because there is war, this is what you can and can't do inside of war. So he attaches it to both exactly what you guys said. Why is it that we can cry out against those who harm us? Can this not be an expression of hate? It is because we're appealing first to God to do it. But number two, it means that we actually care about things that God cares about. If I was indifferent to the sufferings of innocent, poor, weak Christians or whatever, that means I don't understand God. Just flat out does not mean I do not understand God's heart for those who are being persecuted and suffering. If I don't feel the same way that God feels, a desire to deliver them, to rescue them, a desire that the tables be turned, which is exactly what you said, then I do not understand God's character. And so I have a quote there. Our yelling, though not all of it, means we care about something. We care about God. We care about the ways of the kingdom. We care about morality, about justice, about righteousness. The way of faith centers and absorbs our lives. And when someone makes the way difficult, throws stumbling blocks in the path of the innocent, creates difficulties for those young in faith and unpracticed in obedience, there is anger. I like that. That's good. As long as our anger is directed in the right place, right? So if you, as officers in the church, walk into a situation and it's a bad situation, hopefully your anger and your frustration at the situation is not directed at the people as much as it is against the sin and against the problems that those people face. Don't misdirect your frustrations and your anger. Hopefully when you face difficult situations as elders and deacons, your hatred for sin grows because you see the devastation that makes in people's lives. in their marriages, with their kids, with their whatever. But not the people, but the sin. Right? That's what he's trying to say. This psalm is a cry, Lord, do something about this. This is wrong. He's not playing the victim, right? Poor me. He's just simply saying, this is contrary to you and to your kingdom and to your character. Lord, do something, and we will wait for you to do it. That's good. That means I'm in touch with God and his kingdom and the things that he desires. So I apologize for not making it clear that we were supposed to just do the next psalm. I'll remedy that next time. All right, any thoughts or anything about Psalm 129?
The ending of that is so awkward and unattractive. When he says, nor do they who pass by say, the blessing of the Lord be upon you. I mean, just the grammatical, this is what they don't say to you. And then he goes on with a two-line quote of what they don't say to
right,
you.
Right, right.
It's just, I don't find it very satisfying or attractive as poetry.
Okay.
Is it different in the original?
I'm not sure exactly what you mean by, like, well, it just reads bad.
Yeah, it's just awkward. How do I describe that? With which the reaper does not fill his hand, nor the binder of sheaves his arm, nor do they pass by and say, the blessing of the Lord be upon you. The way that kind of reversal, rather than just saying they curse you,
right,
he's saying they don't bless you.
The way that Peterson takes that is he thinks it's like a cartoony,
yeah, that's right,
I'm humor. Read that. Like, yeah. He thinks we should be laughing by this point because of the humorous image behind, like, the you are going to be destroyed so quickly. These are the things that can't happen.
Yeah.
I agree, which is one of the reasons why Peterson, like, he comes to these psalms, he sees things, I wouldn't preach this psalm, I wouldn't even know where to start.
Yeah.
I seriously would read that and be like, okay, 130, oh, great, that looks good. But he sees things and understands, I mean, he gets the Psalter far better than I do. We may not be identical in terms of how we approach the Psalter, but he's tapped into things that I don't see. I would have stared at that and be like, I mean, it's kind of humorous. Like, you can kind of feel there's a jab in there, right? I thought he did a pretty good job of explaining the reversal and patience and stick-to-itiveness versus, you know, what God is going to dish out to those who are on the giving end of that stuff. And I certainly don't have a problem with you saying that. Look, that just doesn't feel comfortable to me.
I think maybe just the English wording is just kind of a little weird. I had to triple take on it myself. So
the content.
It's just a little different. Yeah.
All right. With that, Nate, would you pray for us to we keep plowing away?
Dear Lord, we thank you for this time. We can join together, we can hear from your word and learn more about you, learn about your will for us, for our lives, and for our church, and its life, and for your church as a whole. And we ask that we would be attentive, we ask that we would give us diligence to hear it and to read through the material. We ask that you would lighten us, enable us to serve you, because we know the challenges will be difficult and will test us, and we ask that you would prepare us for that now. Amen.
Amen. Thank you. Okay, so let's
Do we need to start the recorder?
It already has.
Oh. Can we close that door then, please?
Sure.
Thank you.
Wait, let's change things quite a bit. So last time we sort of concluded just simply with connecting the priests and the deacons, right? Anybody want to just give us a quick reason why we did that?
The priests were called to protect God's name and his weight, his honor, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And one way of doing that is because they were responsible for giving out the alms and taking care of people in that role. And you said that the deacons have that same role of providing help in whatever manner that might take and protecting and demonstrating, representing God to those in need.
Okay, good. And Act 6 was really the linchpin, was really fascinating, the way in which the poor are not being taken care of, and so they elect people, and then all of a sudden the priests see it, and they're like, God must be in this, because this is what God told us to do when we were brought out of Egypt. So they are definitely seeing a coordination between what they were called to do and what they're now seeing the church implement, right? That's a very important admission and a significant admission on their part, that they see God doing the same thing, and therefore it must be true. And so they believe, right? So we also talked about Deuteronomy 15. I think this is where we ended, about how to give, what the dangers of giving were, and I'm talking about this. This is really important, Herb and Nate. And in fact, for the next long section, there's a sense in which we're not really talking about deacons at all yet, right? In Deuteronomy 15, this is just God's desire for all of his people. He doesn't want any of his people to be stingy. He doesn't want any of his people to not understand generosity. So in Deuteronomy 15, when it starts talking about having open hands and open hearts, right, he's saying, like, look, it's not just the priests who have open hands and open hearts. It's everybody. Now, we will get to, like, how does that fit in with diaconal work? But the important part is, like, we have to have a vision of the kind of people God desires to cultivate, which is a generous, free, open people who desire to perpetuate the freedom and the liberty that Christ gives to us. And the generosity that he shows us, God wants us to perpetuate that in the lives of other people. Right? And so the priests, in Deuteronomy 14, verse 28, say, at the end of every 3 years, you shall bring out the tithe of your produce in the same year and lay it within your towns. And the Levite, because he has no portion of inheritance with you, the sojourner, the fatherless, and the widow who are within your towns, shall come and eat and be filled, that the Lord your God may bless you in all the work of your hands. The issue here is the gifts of God's people need to be directed at the care of other people. So think of church giving. It's not just to pay the bills. Is that an important part of it? We need a building place, right? Yes. It's not just to pay for the pastor. Is that an important part? Yes. But the giving of God's people is beyond those things. Right? It's an expression of the generosity of God to those who have means. Okay? Therefore, verse 9... you got a question?
Well, kind of. I hope this isn't too tangential, but I'm curious. Do you know what they did the other 2 years with their tithe? And what the poor did? Because it says every 3 years you will bring your tithe.
I think that there are different commands for whether they go to the feasts, they are to bring some. Whether they stay home, they are to bring some. Whether it's talking about their own township, which I think that's what that was talking about, or whether it's talking about going to the temple. the Deuteronomy has all sorts of legislation and all different layers. So I don't think it's saying this is the only time you give. I think it's just addressing a specific issue inside of their own towns.
And would that surplus have been storable? I mean, how is God looking out for the poor?
Gleaning would be another way.
Yeah, okay.
There's lots of that.
Yeah.
They are forbidden from going over their crops twice.
Yeah.
They have to be able to open their crops and say, hey, we've taken it. God told us to leave some for you. Come, take as much as you want. So you've got gleaning, you've got money loaning. Remember we talked that Deuteronomy, I think it's 15 as well, talks about if your brother comes and asks to loan money, you say, okay, even if it's the sixth year. So in that cycle, it's the 7 years that he's talking about. So it's this is just one issue. The principle is at work here. Lend, be free with what you have, whether it's the third year, whether it's your crops, whether it's whatever. The basic principle of Israel's life is open hands and open hearts towards other people. Whether it's the first year, second year, whether it's my crop, whether it's my tithe, I'm willing to give my life for others. Whatever I have, I give. Does that make sense? So there's all sorts of legislations for a variety of situations. So 15:9. External help only, and on the inside you grumble and complain. I think this is literally a place where we ended last time. None of us ever give like that, do we? Right? And I really appreciate, so this is straight from Keller. Tim Keller says, this is the moralist's heart. Do you know what a moralist is?
Well, there's the negative side of it, and then there's the positive side.
Is there a positive?
Not
a moral person, but a moralist.
I think he's saying to look for the good in someone, as opposed to look for the negative in them. Is that not what he meant when he said a moralist?
Mm-mm.
No.
The letter of the law.
Yeah, the moralist is somebody, you could say a legalist.
Oh, I understand, legalist. Sure.
Yeah, a moralist is somebody who believes that based upon their character, God gives them certain things. And it goes a little bit deeper. They believe that if, because I exerted a certain amount of energy, a certain amount of this, that, the other thing, I'm entitled to, and therefore I become the judge for other people. So in giving, this is what the moralist says. I've worked hard, I've sacrificed, I get up at 5:30 in the morning, other people can't too. Why would I give if they're not working as hard as I am? I have no problem helping somebody that through misfortune comes on hard times. But if I don't see them getting up at 4:30, 5:30 in the morning, if I don't see them hitting the streets, if I don't see them right doing whatever to get money, why would I help them? They haven't tapped out all their own personal private resources yet. Right? So this is what he says. I worked hard to get where I am so anyone can as well.
He also brings up moralists, at least at the beginning. I haven't gotten through all 7 chapters yet, but in just the story of the Jericho Road.
You're right, exactly.
Claiming that there was possibly some moralism in the priest and the Levite as well, of just saying, well, my job is in Jerusalem, or, you know, whatever,
right.
You know.
Yep.
Like, my job is bigger than this, or even like, oh, I can't touch an unclean or a dead person, because I don't, like, that there's elements as well of like, well, you can do the right thing even when you're ignoring someone.
One of the dangers, I think, for our culture is to replace the American dream and reality with the Christian life. Is it true in many, many respects in our culture, if you work hard, like, you can do almost anything you want, right? Like, you can go to school, if you work hard enough, if you're willing to put in the time and the energy and not sit and play computer games and whatever, if you're, like, You cannot just plop that right onto the Christian life. Right? The heart, Tim Keller says, this is a better expression of what a Christian heart is. I am only where I am by the sheer and unmerited mercy of God. I am completely equal with all other people. Right? That the moralist says, look what I've done. Right? The faith says, look what God has given me. Right? Do I work hard? Yes. Can I get ahead of my job or whatever? Yes. Can I advance in my education? Yes. Just don't substitute that stuff for the Christian life. One will make you self-righteous, right? It will embitter you towards other people who aren't like you, aren't as together as you, or whatever. We have to resist that kind of heart rather than saying, everything I have is a gift from God. That's it. And I want to be a blessing in other people's lives, just as God has been a blessing in mine. Right? That's just a fundamentally different perspective, right? And unfortunately, as Christians, we have to navigate the fact that I can work hard and get ahead at work and my life of faith in the way I view other people in the church. So what is mercy, then? If we're gravitating now towards expressing kindness and mercy towards others, so now we're just completely dependent upon Keller here. Keller, I think he does a great job of defining mercy and mercy ministry in general, or more specifically, he defines mercy ministry as the desire and the ability to meet the needs of other people. And he calls them even felt needs, right? When I was in grade school, I can remember when that language first started coming up, right? And you got the triangle, and you've got the variety of needs or whatever. There's something sociological important about recognizing that we have different layers of needs, right? And because we're humans, we're not just brains. We're not just computers that just need information, right? But because we're humans, we're not just food receptacles, right? And because we're humans, we're not just sappy emotional basket cases, but we are a complex people of minds, hearts, wills, emotions, sexuality, physical, right, stuff. This is a part of who we are. This isn't some detriment to my being, you know, Mark Collingridge. This is who I am. God made me body and soul together. And without this, I'm not complete. So even at death, when this is separated and my body goes in the grave, I'm not complete until I'm reunited together and have this perfected. Because that's the way God made us. Sociology taps into some of that stuff. Like, people need to know that they're cared for. And that means I listen to them, right? That's one layer. It means that they have food in their stomach. They have shoes on their kids' feet or whatever, right? That's a part of a package of saying, Jesus loves you. Right? That's how he's defining mercy ministry. Now, he's defining it in particular here, not in terms of the ministry of the word, because that's not what deacons do, not in the ministry of discipleship and discipline, which is what elders do, but rather in terms of using the gifts of God's people to minister to some of the layers of people's needs. Right? He also talks about relieving the physical sufferings and misery of others as an extension of Christ's love and ministry to them. I think one of the temptations for relieving these kinds of things and targeting the physical needs of people is that they just see it as a vehicle to share the gospel with them, mm-hmm. rather than actually God cares about that. It's not a means to an end. It's part of a package in which he is blessing people. So he blesses people spiritually, he blesses people emotionally, he blesses. And part of that package, as we'll see by the end of today, is I bless my people with stuff, like tangible, physical, because that's who they are. Just like he did with, think of Adam and Eve. They weren't created in a desert. Right? God didn't create us with one flavor profile. Have you guys ever seen The Matrix? No?
Bits and pieces.
Yeah.
So do you remember that scene where they're on the ship and Neo has finally come out of the Matrix and he's eating slop, and the cook is like, it's got aminos and proteins and everything a growing body needs, right? And the guy next to him, not everything a body needs, right? And that guy's right, because God didn't create us to eat slop that is tasteless, right? Just think about the textures, flavors, all the things that God made and said, you enjoy this. That's God's heart. Right? Fruit, think of the we have a great variety of fruits and vegetables. But we're just scratching the surface from like a worldwide perspective of the variety that God makes. Who did that? He did. Right? I'm just illustrating the fact that God cares about this kind of stuff. It's not, well, it's a means to an end. It's like, no, this is, he made you with taste buds that work together with your nose and your, we are ridiculously complex in just the ways that we can enjoy certain things. God made us that way. He didn't have to, right? Maybe that's not the right way of saying it. It's better just to say positively.
Yeah, it was his will.
He's good. Because he is inherently generous and thoughtful. When we think about people, the diaconal ministry is not just a means to an end, but rather an expression of Christ's love as Lord and Redeemer over a needy people. And he comes with the gospel, he comes with the church to be a social, right? To interact and to listen and to care, but he also comes with people who are like, you need shoes on your feet, you need food on your table, you need, right? We love you, and so does Christ, so here you go, right?
Backing up a little bit to, like, so B1A, meeting the felt needs, you mentioned, says, of the saints. And you've mentioned, like, the giving, mercy ministry is not just a means to, and you know, give them a bowl of soup and then send them down for the gospel. But where...
What, did you believe me if I told you we're going to get there?
Yeah. Especially if I... Wait. No. But yeah.
No,
that would be my question of...
Yeah.
In what ways do we focus only on the church? In what ways should we be...
Those are great questions.
Yeah.
And they're questions that we will not be able to answer exhaustively in this class. I'm going to give a couple of ideas that I think will help. It's just one of those conversations that I think, as deacons, we need to just, like, constantly press. Not in theory, but, like, when situations happen and you guys are like, hey... We saw ... What do you think we as a church can do about that particular situation?
There's an inequity or an injustice.
Or something that maybe of a friend or somebody that's not a part of our church, and we say, but we would really like to help. Okay, let's do it. There you're giving not a theory, like, can we help people outside the church? You're saying, there's a need, we can actually address it. Should we? Can we? Then we attack. But I think there are some, like, not guidelines, probably not the right
framework.
Word. Framework, yeah, that's probably a better word. Framework of saying, can we, should we, and if so, then what do we do? And Paul's pretty clear. You care first for the church and then for the, right? I mean, he's not willy-nilly. he's very specific. Even the Deuteronomy is like, care for the widows and sojourners. It's not that they aren't present, but widows and orphans and your brothers first, right? In the sense of like, it's not just to the world, but it's not just to the church. So we'll try to address some of that stuff.
Quick question. The felt needs, the term that he uses, felt. I struggle with that. You know, are we meeting people what they feel like they need or what we really think they need?
Yeah, so the word felt there is kind of a technical term, which is why it's in brackets.
Yeah.
It doesn't equal feel. Felt needs is like a code word for, like, basic physical necessities.
Okay.
Right? That's why it's like this.
Right.
It's just code word in, like, sociological categories.
Yeah, I've heard that.
It's,
yeah.
It's not like somebody really feels like they need a fancier car.
A car or a TV. Like, my TV's only 20 inches. Church, could you get me a 48-inch?
Right.
You know, that's not what that's not what felt means. Think of this as basic.
Okay.
Human.
I wish they'd use that.
I agree.
But you can't just use that because there are emotionally basic human needs.
Yeah.
That's not what mercy ministries do either. It's more of like, how do I care for their basic human physical needs?
Okay.
I think that's under there. Someone look it up in Wikipedia. Maybe that'll help.
The first time I heard the phrase used in that way was like White Horse Inn or guys talking at that level, and they always use it in like a pejorative sense.
Right.
So do they have a different scope in mind? Are they thinking about like the sermon and people trying to meet felt needs in a sermon? Because like,
yes, I've only heard of it in a with
like,
negative connotations.
Right. Like, we're not trying to meet these felt needs. We need to give them the gospel. It's kind of the general thrust of how they usually address it.
Tim is challenging that.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
He's absolutely saying, if you isolate people to be even spiritual receptacles, you do not understand human beings. He's challenging the idea that you can minister to somebody's spirit and neglect their so-called felt needs. Now, having said that, it's possible that guys like on the White Horse Inn are mocking the idea that a sermon is designed to meet felt needs. So that, hey, bring your checkbooks on Sunday. I'm going to do a sermon on how to balance your checkbook. They would scoff and ridicule that idea, right? With good reason, because the Bible doesn't do that, right? But if they're mocking it to the exclusion, that doesn't really matter. That's not really the church's business. Tim's definitely challenging that.
Okay.
Absolutely challenging that.
I think most of the time they're probably talking about like therapeutic sermons.
And that's possible.
That sounds sounds about right.
But
which deserve to be marked.
Exactly.
This is a very challenging book. This is a very very challenging book.
Steve and I were saying exactly the same thing last night. Like, uncomfortably challenging. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Like.
No.
Yeah. And what I appreciate is the boldness that he has as a pastor. I mean, because he's a pastor, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he's writing essentially to deacons. That's what he's trying to do here. Because the whole book is designed at Mercy Ministry, which is, in his mind, overseen by the deacons. He is being very, very straightforward and I think, tapping into the ethos of Scriptures in a way that most pastors are uncomfortable doing. I mean, statements he makes, like, if you're not willing to give to embetter somebody else's station in life at the detriment of your own, you don't understand giving. And you're just like, okay, I'll see you guys. I mean, that's challenging because on just so many levels, it challenges my heart, right? It challenges like my ideas of a pastor and like the bounds of a pastor. Would I stand up and say, like, we're not actually like being faithful to Jesus if it doesn't hurt? Most of us are pretty comfortable.
Dang straight.
Right?
And this is
very uncomfortable. Because he really believes that giving is uncomfortable. And if it's comfortable, then that means you're not really tapping into Jesus and really grasping right? I mean, we're just so used to saving money and buying things we want and upgrading this. And I mean, that's just kind of the mentality that we have. Tim is like, no. We're cutting against the grain of that. Like, that's the world telling you that you have the right and entitled to these things. It's your money, and you can just use it however you want, as long as you just give a little bit to the church. He's challenging that idea. That's hard to hear, right? Mm-hmm. Because which one is easier? Right? Watching out for yourself. Plugging away a little bit for this and that, and sort of insulating yourself and protecting your interests and all that kind of stuff.
Bigger bonds.
Yeah.
And this is 30 years old.
The book
is 1980.
Yeah. So
he says, I noticed he talked about the 5%. Nowadays it's the 1%.
Oh. Well, he says something like by the year 2005, the numbers ought to be, and I'm going, what the heck? and so then I go back and find out, this is almost 30 years old.
Yeah. So do we know who Tim Keller is by chance?
Nope.
PCA pastor in
New York, right? Tim Keller is a PCA minister in New York City. It's called Redeemer PCA. He's very different than what you would expect. When he preaches, he's like super conversational. There are some preachers, if you looked on YouTube, they're all personality. Like John Piper is super like enthusiastic and dramatic. This guy is just, well, when we look at 1 Corinthians 1, we see this. And that's connected and...
he's kind of got like this lean on the pulpit.
Exactly. Like we're sitting around a fire and he's just like teaching and we're sitting at his feet or whatever with his little cardigan sweater and stuff. Right? But when you hear him, you're like,
does he change it?
Wow. That's really good.
Walks over to
he may be something of a personality, but it's not the kind of personality that you would think is. It's not dramatic personality, but there's a deep charisma to the guy, right? And he kind of writes that way. It's not overly technical, but really insightful, right? Big Church, he is responsible for a massive movement inside of the PCA of church planting. He is all about church planting. And church planting with this kind of a model where I come to people not just as a talking head to fill their brains, but to say, Jesus loves you as a person, and we are here to love you and care for you as a whole. Now, like I said, I think there is a little bit of a bristling by the White Horse Inn, and even in some circles of the OPC, there's something about this that we just... Nope. This makes me really uncomfortable.
The White Horse Inn, is that like a Reformed blog or something?
It's a radio station. It started as a radio station, but now they have a magazine, Modern Reformation. But Michael Horton, Rod Rosenblatt,
Kim
Riddlebauer. There's three or four guys that are kind of the spearheaders of the whole thing. It was sort of Michael Horton's way of getting Reformed theology and Reformed thinking out. And so it's like it's around the world now, I think, at this point. And, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think so.
Put the cap on. Thank you. I think the only other book that ever affected me like this is Radical.
By David Platt.
David Platt.
Oh, yeah.
That shook me deeply. And this has also, toward the end, when he gives like three different examples, here's a man who lost his job because he can't sleep well, and because he lost his job, they're behind on their rent. Because they're behind on the rent, there's a lot of anger in the family. Remember, and it includes all of those felt needs, you know, the internal and all of those, and says, what are you going to do with this? And then there's this other person. Remember, and then this other one where there's no food in the house, and the woman has sent her daughter out to occasionally prostitute herself. What are you going to do with all of this? Do you remember reading those, man, and you're thinking, okay, there are no easy fixes to these sorts of multiple layers of need, and they're all there. It's not like you fix one and you can fix them all. They're all sort of meshed together.
It's like you have to fix them all to fix them all.
That's what I've done. I'll pass to Mark and say,
I got some. Here's a little knot.
Yeah.
pull on his string and see what bell rings at the end. I think that's part of the impulse to just minister to the spiritual person, because in some sense it's a lot harder because you can't like control it and fix it, but in some senses it's way easier because you can just say, I gave you the gospel, you know, hope the prostitution thing gets better, and you know, see you later.
Or you can wrap that up into more pious, I gave you the gospel, and if God chooses to use it, then you'll be okay.
Yeah.
I'm just trusting the Lord.
Right, that's the Calvinist.
Exactly. Yep.
The state patch.
Yeah. Yeah. From getting my hands dirty. Right?
Right. Yeah.
People's needs are messy, right? That's what's uncomfortable. It's one thing to tackle your own mess. It's another thing to change somebody else's diapers. Have you ever changed a diaper of a kid that wasn't your own?
Stinky.
Oh, it's horrible. Right? I mean, it's bad enough to change your own kid's diapers, but to do it for somebody else's.
It's different.
It's different. It's uncomfortable. It requires a fundamental change in how you view people and the grace of Christ in your own heart. I mean, it really, really changes how I see people. Hopefully. So deacons in mercy, look at Romans 12:8, which we've talked about. So Herb, you read Romans 12:8. It's there on the page if you want. And Nate, Luke 22:24-27.
Romans 12:8, the one who does acts of mercy with cheerfulness.
Okay. I don't know if you remember when we talked about this a long time ago, when we were looking at Romans 12, Ephesians 4, and 1 Corinthians 12. That was like months ago. The question was, how does Jesus mediate his gifts, right? How do they get to us? And we looked that Jesus, all the gifts reside in Jesus. He is the fullness of everything that the church is and does resides perfectly in Jesus. Every category you can think of. He then gives it by his Spirit. This is 1 Corinthians 12. That we participate in the fullness of Christ by the Spirit. And then they come to us. The Spirit applies them to us by faith. Romans 12. So this is Ephesians 4. This is 1 Corinthians 12. And then this is Romans 12. And you'll notice that Romans is all he who, you know, act in accordance with your gift in proportion to the faith given to you. And I think by the time you get to Romans 12, he's saying, look, there are a group of people in the church that are responsible in some way for whatever he calls the acts of mercy. He's not denying that the whole church is to be merciful. He's saying that there will be some set aside to perform acts of mercy. And remember I asked you, what's the one thing, if you're going to show mercy, you need to have with it? It's joy. You have to. Because think of Deuteronomy 15. If I have an open hand, but a closed heart, if I begrudgingly give to people, or if I'm not as free on the inside as I am on the outside, then I'm not really giving as Jesus gives. And so he says, look, you who do acts of mercy, do it with cheerfulness. That's your part of your faith, is just trusting that you're operating and expressing Christ by his Spirit in your life and in the lives of other people. And so I will joyfully express mercy to you. And remember, we're talking about mercy. Deacons are not simply people who help people become more responsible and reliable. That's not mercy. Mercy is when you bless people when they don't deserve it. It's a genuine act of mercy. Now, is the goal, which we'll talk about later, is the goal to enable them to continue to be lazy bums? No. Righteousness is still a fundamental reality of diaconal ministry. We want people to grow, right? That's the goal. Remember we talked about Deuteronomy 6 and First Corinthians, or the Great Commission. The goal is a people who grow in faith, hope, and love. That's what we want. And if giving is a detriment to their faith, hope, and love, then we don't give. Because that has the priority. Right? So in our mercy and in our giving, we're still serving the primary goal, which is a people that love Jesus, trust Him, and serve Him. But if by my giving, right, I'm, who knows what I'm doing, keeping people stuck in their rebellious, disobedient ways, then I'm not being merciful to them.
Does a deacon get involved in the rehabilitation, the counseling, the going after spiritual needs?
I think inevitably yes. I don't think, they're not just a checkbook, right? So if I can't reduce the pastor to a doctrinal talking head, and I can't reduce the elders to just the moral police of the church, I can't reduce the deacons to the checkbook. Yeah, here. You need money? Cool. Here you go. And then, cool. Get out of here. You're great. That would be... That's not actually doing anything either. Because the needs are complex and they're all, like, ministering and they're all part of the person. So if, as a deacon, I minister to somebody's felt needs, I am inevitably crossing into emotional, spiritual, and other needs, which I have to be able to competently address and keep in mind.
You're constantly talking with pastors and elders in the church, so
exactly
you know what's going on.
Absolutely.
With the person, so they know what they can do.
Absolutely. And at the very end, we'll talk about how do deacons and elders relate to each other, and this is exactly what we're talking about, is you guys aren't independently doing your own thing, but you're also not under our thumb just to do what we tell you to do. Like, you have a ministry, you have a task, you have a calling, which the elders don't have. That we have to be able to keep that true and balance the fact that they're supposed to be working together to meet the full needs of God's people. Right? Yeah. We've never had deacons at Covenant. In the 15 years I've been here, we've never had them. For whatever reason, the elders, myself in the session, have always been responsible. If there are needs, we go and we meet those needs. And now, the benefit of that is I know what's going on. Like, on all the levels, primarily, of a person's life. But that what has to happen now is, how do we work together to help people who have these in church? Elders, pastor, deacon, how do we, you know.
And that's because we do so little in the way of mercy ministry.
And that's entirely right.
I think we're all sitting here thinking of people, wow, these folks need, you can see they have felt needs, right? I mean, are you guys thinking of people?
Always.
You're sat here thinking of folks, wow, they're really going through the wars, financially or spiritually, emotionally, physically. I got names going through my mind.
We don't have a budget for any money set aside for mercy ministries.
Yeah, and we're going to have to talk about sort of when we talk about the mechanism, which is down at the bottom. There's something in my mind. I'm not sure I like the idea of having a benevolent budget. I'm just not sure that that's the vision that God has. Is like, hey, we give and we just take a little bit of a piece of it and set it aside. And that's kind of what you have to work with, rather than saying, look, if there are needs in the church, the budget's open. Like, that's just the way it is. Like, we're not giving to so that part of us, you know, can take care of. But, it, like, if there's needs, then we'll meet the need, right? I mean, that's the goal. And not only that, but I have no problem, especially as we work together, the deacons urging people in the church, like, it's time to give. It's not time to save. And we can lay needs before people. If it's necessary, 10% is not, as we're reading, is just not the biblical model of sacrificial giving. And so if there are needs, not only do you have the budget, but you've got the people of God sitting there that can be urged, especially if the deacons come and say, hey, we've got this problem. We need you to step it up, right? You just read the relationship of Acts 4 and Acts 6. Acts 4, remember we read, is that people are selling things to meet needs. Mm-hmm. And in Acts 6, it's like, how do we administer the gifts of God's people? No problem going back and saying, like, we need to give more. Like, we need to make people as uncomfortable as Tim is making us. Mm-hmm. Right? There's no problem with that.
It is interesting that he even brings out the two sides, though. He said, Ron Sider, right, who says, you know, the more you earn, the more you should give. You should not be increasing your lifestyle as your pay goes up. And then there's the other guys on the other spectrum that says the only requirement is 10%. There's no, you know, and those, and he says, here's the opposing sides of that same argument. And then, of course, he says, you know, essentially, would you like it if God only gave you 10%?
Right.
And then you say, okay, that reels you back in a little bit.
Right.
His mercy is not
limited.
Limited, yes. All right, we'll go 12%. So you want Jesus to go to cross 10% for you?
If the, like, as the deacons push people to give sacrificially, does that just look like you guys getting up on Sunday after church and saying, hey, here's what we're dealing with, please pray about giving? Or is it like Herb calls me and says, hey, Aaron, we have a serious need, can you help?
I don't know, like, specifically. Obviously, the one of appealing to the whole church is, we use that now, like,
right,
with the Yorks, mm-hmm, or when the Johnsons left, right?
Mm-hmm.
Here we are, essentially no job for him, and so we're like, look, we want to bless them. Like, we can't send them away and say, hey, thanks for your 5 years here, hope you can eat macaroni and cheese for the rest of your, right? No, we blessed them and gave, right? That was a church-wide thing. I don't know why there would be a problem. If somebody knew you had a particular whatever,
yeah,
to meet a particular need, I do that as a pastor. Hey, can you go da-da-da-da? Because I know that person is perfectly equipped to help that other person, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
That's the same thing with me. People call me specifically to address a specific need. Why couldn't they,
yeah,
do that in that other areas? You know what I'm saying? So I wouldn't be opposed to either one.
We did that also for the family that went to... Oh, now I can't even remember the names. Ah, hate that. They came in and they spoke at
the Covenant. The Nelsons?
Oh.
The Nelsons.
Mm-hmm.
They gave up everything and headed out to the mission field. It was like, blows my mind.
Totally.
So, and so we helped.
Uganda?
So we held. Huh?
Was it Uganda? That
Uganda? Sounds about right.
Richard, your lid is kind of off. Your lid on your cup. Just make sure it doesn't, like,
pop off when you're drinking it or whatever.
Was it Uganda?
That's
it was.
Because they had kids, right? They had, like, maybe a child that might have been six.
Yeah.
Uganda or Ethiopia or something. Yeah.
And so we held up, you know, for a couple of weeks. Or was it a couple of weeks, or did we just set up 1 week or whatever? So we just set
whatever
up
it was.
Brother Chen, we were able to bless them, which was really neat.
I, as I stand here, and if John were sitting here, he would say the same thing. I've always been blown away by the giving of Covenant. Like, when the church is called on to give, our church has responded fairly well. We're, you know, our session has made choices to, so when we first got the letter from Dan, for instance, the Yorks, hey, we're going into ministry, would you help us? We got that letter at the same time that the Johnsons were leaving. And we were like, look, we can give to Dan later, we need to take care of the Johnsons. So we took the offering. And we were like, so we have this letter and this request, let's take a breather for a few months, and then in September we'll take an offering, right? So it was, what, April or May or whatever it was for the Johnsons that we did the offering. Probably April. Or maybe even earlier, March. And then we waited, and then we did the Yorks, right? And in both of them, so I don't remember, do you guys remember what the figure was for the Johnsons? It's pretty ridiculous.
Like 6,000.
I think it was around $6,000. Well, we did three for the Yorks, which is, that's awesome, right? To be able to write a check and say, you're not in our denomination, but we are continuing to invest in the church by investing in Dan and Megan. That's awesome, right? And they'll be, I suspect, probably surprised at the fact that there's a $3,000 check coming from our church for them. That's great, you know. Our church, I've never been disappointed in the way that our church has given. Does that mean we've tapped into and everything? I can tell you personally, I haven't tapped into the ways of giving that I could, right? Does our church, can it continue to be encouraged to mature in its giving? Absolutely. Right? Have you ever read, I think it's 1 Thessalonians 5, where Paul says to the Thessalonians, your love is renowned among the churches. And excel still more.
What was that last part?
Excel still more. Like, you never get to the point where, like, you guys are great. Just as you are, you're good. You got it kicked. So he can affirm, like, your love and care for people is astounding. Like, the churches in Macedonia and Corinth or whatever, they're amazed at how amazing you guys are. And then he's like, excel more. Mature and grow, because you can't tap into God's love enough, right? That's kind of the point. He does the same thing with the Corinthians in 1 Corinthians, 2 Corinthians 8. Look, your giving is, everybody knows how generous you are. Keep giving, right? As much as, like, I'm impressed by the giving of Covenant, it doesn't mean that we're like, okay, we got it. You know, every 6 months we can take a special offering and pat ourselves on the back and we're good. Right? So we can grow, we can mature, we can continue to give. There haven't been deep, deep needs at Covenant. Right? You don't see kids running around without shoes on or...
well, you do.
Right, plug your ears. Yeah, exactly. Out of necessity, pants are mostly on.
You can afford a boat.
I can see all the kids without shoes as the boat improves.
Say, let them get a job.
So good.
There was a gal, D.R. Lorino, just couldn't make jobs work, couldn't make ends meet, and we intervened a couple times for her. Eddie was a really, really difficult diaconal thing because he would take the money and use it for drugs. And so it became where you had to be very specific. No, I will take you to the store and I will buy the next 6 months of your phone plan or whatever. I'm not going to give you $120.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Am I being mean or whatever? He probably thought so. But whatever, right? I'm not going to take God's people's money and say, you shoot it in your veins, and that's okay. Right? No, I'm not going to do that. If I know what's happening. If I don't know and I can't control the situation, then that is what it is. But I knew Eddie, right? I knew what was going on. And I probably shouldn't have even paid for his phone because we found out that that was the ways in which he was doing all sorts of ridiculous things. The things our phones can do are pretty amazing in terms of meeting people and disgusting things. But he was also somebody who didn't work, right? Paul is like, look, if you don't work, you don't eat, right? Like he... The issue of mercy and the call of God upon the... It's a very, very difficult thing to navigate.
That's a hard one, though, as well, because he even gets it in this book, and you see from more liberals. I mean, some people argue that there just aren't enough jobs. You know, he almost, at least in the first chapter, first couple chapters, gives that impression as well, and I don't know if that's... I mean, that in itself is a debate, but it's like,
Yeah.
Where do you draw the line between somebody who can't work because they've, you know, maybe you see them now and it seems like they aren't even trying, but maybe they tried for years and are just
spent,
done.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Like, never found their place in society and decided it was, you know, like.
Yeah, and we would have to deal with that, right? And that takes a lot of time to navigate through their story and how what is best to help them and all that sort of stuff. And we would have to face that. That's where wisdom comes with sitting around a table like this and saying, these are the issues, what do we think? Right? Not all of the issues require that kind of thought. If somebody comes to you and says, look, we're up to our eyeballs in credit card debt and we can't pay our electric bill. Okay, how much do you need? Like, that doesn't take a lot of thought to say, yeah, you need to keep your electricity on so that you can take care of your family or whatever.
You don't say, well, show me your credit card bill.
Yeah, yeah, like, I would really like to see. It's just quick, easy, we love you, right?
But is it deacons? I mean, does the church help with credit card? Because, I mean, like Aaron kind of alluded to, I mean, obviously, yeah, in most situations you'd want to just be merciful, but yet if it keeps happening, or, like, but yet there is possibly an issue, you know, maybe not. Maybe it's full up with medical debt, or, you know, they pay
right
off of, you know, whatever. There could be good reasons, there could be normal reasons of just they got in over their head. There could be, like, there could be a whole spectrum,
yeah,
and it,
yeah.
Is it
not? That's
like,
all you're admitting,
yeah,
is not all of them are just quick, easy.
Right. How much does the church say, okay, we're going to help you with your gambling problem, or with your lack of budgeting problem, or with your, you know, whatever, versus there's probably other, I mean, there's other parachurch ministries, there's secular...
Totally,
like,
yep. Yeah, and part of what the church can do is to direct them and say, look, we're not equipped to... I can't help you with that. Go to the seminar. We'll pay for it. Right? There's no problem. I've got counseling situations where I'm like, look, I would love to log in all the hours I could. But you're dealing with stuff I don't understand. Right? So take Ruth Hader, for example, eating disorder. I wouldn't know the first thing about the complexities of eating disorders, the mental situation, the emotional. But can I go to her and pray with her and administer the gospel to her and talk to her? Yeah, that. But in terms of counseling, I'm like, three cheers for Children's Hospital.
Because they know that stuff.
Because they know that stuff. Are they Christians or whatever? No, but do they understand how the brain works and the mind works?
Mm-hmm.
Could they say to her, like, this is what's happening in the inside, and she's just like, I didn't know anybody understood me.
Yeah.
I mean, it's amazing, right?
Yeah.
I have no problems knowing my place in that kind of a situation, right? I'm not going to peacock and say, no, you can't talk to her. She's a Christian, and only Jesus knows who she is, right?
Does it contribute to their faith, hope, and love is, I think, what it comes back down to.
Right.
And does it, or does it, you know, knowingly contributing to a pattern of a lifestyle, and it's like, well, yeah, I mean, it's, you don't know everything, right? So if you're contributing to their faith, hope, and love in Jesus, and I would say that is probably the biggest framework, or the biggest foundation, or the look to piece in the equation, right?
I mean, there
not
is
the
that
equation, but
thing,
the situation.
Yeah. So at the church where I was deacon for 3 years at, we had a bit more policies. I mean, it was kind of, because it was very rotational, you know, I just kind of fill in the spot. There were some basically guidelines, and I don't think they were completely off, but yet they probably could have been better. We're in the sense, we had a policy where if somebody comes, asks for something the first time, you help them. That got added to, well, call the sheriff to make sure they're not, like, you know, trying to flee the law, and that's why they need gas all of a sudden. You know, right? Like, so, of course, it became this way.
It's always quiet.
all of
our bills.
Yeah.
Just yeah, love the bank.
But and then the second time, well, I think that was the worry. I don't think there was, as far as I know, there was no specific thing where it was like a big oops, but it just, you know, got added to the list of like, ah, maybe we shouldn't just always completely help the sojourner. But, and then, you know, the second time they come, then ask them, which I think, or then, you know, get a bit geekier, which I think in some ways was on the right track, but in other ways may not. Certainly, there's room for improvement, but I...
So there's a couple
things, too, where it's just like, well, okay, we'll help you with your electric bill.
There's a couple of things I think that will... We probably will not have to face very much of that because we don't have a church building. There's not a location map where people can drive to and knock on the door and say, I need da-da-da-da, right? We do have a phone number, so I do get phone calls, but I don't ever check that phone because the phone I use is my cell, but the church number is totally different. And the phone book is the other thing. It's literally families just call... Mm-hmm. Right down, and Covenant is pretty high because of the sea, right? So I get a constant stream, and they keep calling the same person calls me. Hey, my name's da 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 da. I da 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 need this and this. 2 weeks later, hi, my name is da 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 da. I need da 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 da.
That's
because they're literally just going through the phone book, and my number's just the next one. Do you help people? Mm-hmm. Right, but because we don't have a church building. We don't have something for people like that to just be like...
We have had people show up a few times.
Just a couple of times, yeah. Right? And I took them, you know, it was during Sunday school, took them to the gas station, put my credit card in, paid for the gas, right?
Did you call the sheriff first?
I didn't call the sheriff first. in terms of debt, like you brought up the issue of debt, I can tell you by experience, so we had a pastor who... Like, bless his soul, the guy is, like, if you were to meet the guy, super nice, genuine, would give you the shirt off of his back. Terrible pastor. And he, in order to save money, he kept rolling his credit card debt from one credit card to another. Right? Which is, I mean, if you're into the credit card game and you're going to play that game, it's not a bad idea because you avoid all the interest payments on it. But the problem was is he was making purchases that were necessary on a credit card. So like a used car, he put it, and he didn't tell his wife. And so through spiraling around his credit card, like jumping from Wells Fargo to Chase to whatever all the names are, by the time he came to us, he had like $26,000 of uncollateral debt. Right, so no house to show for it. The car was a beater. And our Presbyterian paid it just to set him free. And we made him go back to his wife. I mean, it's kind of messy, right? I don't know if that was the right thing to do. It obviously was an incredible act of mercy because it was sort of like a loan in the sense of, like, if you find yourself in a better situation later, pay us back. I have no idea whether he did or not, but the whole presbytery voted to basically give this guy, I think it was $21,000 or something ridiculous. And I was on the inside of dealing with the guy. We did not make that motion. It came from someone outside who looked at the situation, and they were like, what if we paid this off as a group so that he could, in a sense, start over, right? Very year of Jubilee-ish. So I do know that churches aren't opposed to even the foolish practices of people intervening and saying, you need a fresh start, and you need a place to stand, but this is how you're going to stand from now on. You're not going to hide debt from your wife. You're not going to pay for used cars on a credit card, because you can get a loan and have better interest rates than playing, right? I mean, there was just a number of things where, like, that's just bad practice, and it's stressful. Right, because if you get caught or one week behind that transfer, you're talking like 28%, or I mean, it's like, and then your late fees and it's over. Right, that's a very stressful financial game you're playing. And so there was a number of things, and we were, you know, whether he listened, we have no idea, right? He ended up...
So he wasn't in the presbytery.
He was on his way out of the presbytery, yeah. So
he may have been foolish, but he may have saved his marriage.
Maybe. Who knows? Yeah, but that's, again, that's sort of an, what mercy is despite the foolish acts of people, you say, it's okay, we'll take care of it. They're like, really? I make the dumb decision and you guys won't? Yeah, because that's what Jesus does. Like, it's not like we are upstanding people and God is like, okay, since you make such good decisions, I'll help you. It's like, you guys are a train wreck. Now let me put the pieces back together. Right? So we don't help people that aren't responsible or just responsible, and they're just kind of in a tough spot. Like, that's not real mercy, not necessarily. Though that can be mercy, right? Well, we want to help you because you're in a tough spot. So I can tell you by experience that even large amounts of debt, the church has said, we'll take care of that. Right or wrong. It's not off the table. Covenant's not in a position to write a check. Right. Not really. But then again, then you're pressing, what are we doing? Why are we saving our money? Right? If there was genuine need, would Covenant say, be happy, be fed, just somewhere else, right? Or you know what I mean? Would it stretch us to write a check that large? Okay, right? So, that would be tough decisions by the elders, right? Because then the elders would have to come to the church and say, this is what we think our church should do. Do you think people are happy cutting a $25,000 check? Oh, they would freak out, right?
Does the or something like that, would the elders, deacons, the session, or even the presbytery have the right to write a check like that without telling the congregation?
No, I think that would be really offensive.
Yeah.
Without telling the congregations,
yeah.
So presbytery can, because churches give and then they decide what to do with it. So we were all
presbytery has their own budget.
Right? Has their own budget.
Right.
But we all made the decision. It was a vote. It wasn't a committee that made the decision. Hey, we decided to do this, and we're all like, what? If we did that to the church, of something of that large of an expenditure, and we're like, hey, we just didn't feel it. And someone, like, at the end of the year is like, what was this back in June? Like, why do we have no savings left? And we're like, well, we wrote a check to people would be,
yeah,
that would be really offensive. Yeah, you think?
It might hurt the pastor's employment.
Yeah, exactly. Total coup. No, we would definitely go to the church and say, this is what we think. Right? We wouldn't run over the congregation. And maybe that's just the way I think church in decisions like that should go. We've never tried to force anything on our church. Even when the elders were like, we want to go to weekly communion, we went to the church and said, look, we're not going to do this because we want to do it. If you guys are sitting here kicking against us, that just is contrary to the whole point of why we want to go to weekly communion. And so even if we're convicted about it and want to do it, if the church was like, we don't want any part of that, we'd have been like, okay, you know.
That brings up an interesting point, because we sit here having read this and we're sort of processing this and working through this, and this is the approach that we are going to take if we approach the congregation with a need. But the congregation does not have the benefit of having ground through this and come to their own,
right,
in their own hearts.
Right, and that was the same thing with weekly communion. So I preached 9 sermons.
Wow.
And by the end, nobody said a word. Right, so if there was really a need that we felt like we are going to put the savings of our church on the line, I would venture to guess the elders would say, Mark, you need to preach a few times before we do this. Like, you need to walk and give time for the people to process it like we've done.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah, you can't just spring it on them because they're going to be like, what are you talking about? You need to give them the same tools that we have. And when we made this decision, So preach. And, you know, I can think of a couple texts just like this. This is what we feel like God is doing, is calling us to do. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, those would be, I mean, we're talking about major decisions. We're not talking about taking Eddie and getting dinner. I'm not going to consult the congregation or taking DR to the grocery store. But anything that would fundamentally affect the entire church, with the communion would be an example, or cutting a check for $25,000.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Same as in a marriage. There are some expenditures you don't need the okay of your spouse, but
right.
others this needs
right.
to be a joint
Anything
decision.
I spend
is
to find
you mean I
Heather must
it
come to me. Or to turn that off quick.
No more lipsticks.
I don't like that color of nail polish. I don't know if you guys know this, but the word deacon, are you familiar with what the word deacon means? Like if etymology meant anything, it doesn't always mean anything, but waiter, server. Which I think is perfect, right, for the function that they perform, especially when you look at Acts 6 and the fact that
we can't be waiting on tables instead of being apostles or whatever.
Right. Yeah, there's something perfect. I'm not saying it that's what it means as to be a deacon, right? But there is a reason why that particular word was chosen, is because it just encapsulates like what their desire is. Like a table waiter is very tangible aid and help to people. Luke 22:24-27.
A dispute also arose among them as to which of them was to be regarded as the greatest. And he said to them, the kings of the Gentiles exercise lordship over them, and those in authority over them are called benefactors. But not so with you. Rather, let the greatest among you become as the youngest, and the leader as one who serves. For who is the greater, one who reclines at table, or one who serves? Is it not the one who reclines at table? But I am among you as the one who serves.
Right, just a completely ridiculous statement by Jesus. I think this fixes a potential danger of church office. And I think there is a perception in the church that there's kind of a hierarchy, right? Right? And part of that is completely visible, right? The pastor is usually the face of the church, right? He preaches, he's visiting people, he's doing right. He seems like he's the face of the church. And these two, most of their work is just sort of largely unnoticed and behind the scenes. Just the way it is. Right? If you were to come to church for the first month and observe covenant, would you know that John Dibler is an elder? No idea. Would you know the amount of hours we meet and talk and pray? And no clue, right? Does John care? No. If you came to church for 4 weeks, you'd be like, that's the pastor. Like, Mark's the pastor, and, like, I know him, I see him, he's talked to me, he's whatever, right? Deacons, are in large part the same way. The danger is, like, they see this as, like, a hierarchy of importance in the church. Jesus just completely turns that upside down. Just totally, he just does not confirm the ways of the world. There's nothing at all in Christ's mind that there's some sort of a hierarchy here. He calls the shots, right? He's the boss up here. The pastor's the boss, right? The elders are the henchmen. And these guys are just running around doing whatever.
Drones and workers.
Right, Jones and workers.
Just
in the
taking care of the building.
Right, that's all they do.
Time for a screenshot.
Jesus is just not validating that at all. Jesus is like, if you want to be the greatest, this is what your name is. If you want to understand what my kingdom is like, this is the people I put at the top. Mm-hmm. The people who serve, right? Because he identifies himself right there. The word servant and deacon are the same, right? That's why I'm bringing up Luke 22. Deacons should not think somehow that their work is somehow less important or inferior, or just it's a stepping stone. Well, I can't wait to be an elder, so I'll be a deacon first. As if they didn't have a unique calling to fulfill that they should rejoice in and see themselves as servants mm-hmm. in God's kingdom. And as great for it. Right? So Luke 22 is like the lens through which I look at church life. Does that help? I think there are misunderstandings. Or, to put it another way, as if these guys, because they take care of the physical needs of the church or whatever, yeah, they're not really that important. This guy is really important because he's preaching. That betrays an idea that the physical, it doesn't really matter. I mean, we got to take care of it because we got it, but it doesn't really matter. This is what really matters. It just betrays that we're human beings that require all three, and that we all have a specific, unique calling. And that unless we're all working together, like, the church isn't what it should be.
Mm-hmm. Especially if you see Reformed kind of perspective where it focuses on teaching the Scripture mm-hmm. and not mercy.
Right. Yeah, is there a priority? Yes. Can I have the gospel and be naked and poor and diseased and dying? Absolutely. And I can have a nice car with brand new shoes and go straight to hell. Right? I'm not denying the priority of the gospel truth. Right? I'm not, so whatever I'm, and neither is Tim, right? That's not his point either. It just gets so imbalanced and just so dehumanizes people. Mm-hmm. Whereas the offices do exactly the opposite of that, where God is like, I care about the whole person, and so I'm going to minister to the whole person and value the servants in the church. So the next heading here, God's mercy to us, he has a whole section, which I just have briefly outlined here, is that mercy is God's compassion in action. Right? You guys, basically, that's almost a quote right out of the book. Think of mercy as God seeing the sufferings and the difficulties of those people and compelled to act. That's mercy. So deacons ought to have, like, I see this need, and my heart goes out to it, and I'm enabled and called to either meet the need or to rally the troops to meet the need. That's the deacon's responsibility, is to articulate and give expression to God's desire to have compassion on people and their needs. It's truly an expression of God's compassion for his people. So we're going to take a break there. If you guys need some more coffee, snack, bathroom, whatever, now's the time. It's 10 o'clock right now. So just 10 minutes or whatever, and we'll come back.